Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. Hey, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So glad you're with me today. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I am your traditional host here. And today we're going to have kind of a session with Frank Curzio. We're not going to break it up in beginning, middle, end this time. We're not going to just bring him on for a little bit. We're going to have a good, long discussion with Frank because there's a lot going on in these markets right now. And I talked to him. He's quite the mentor. And if you haven't read or heard his information, listen to his podcast and subscribe to his various newsletters, it's really something that would be very enlightening. I have the privilege of getting it from the horse's mouth. So, Mr. Horsey, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for that introduction.
Yeah, no problem. Call you Mr. Ed from now on. How's that?
Sounds good to me, bud.
So let's talk about, there's so much going on. We got economics, we have world issues, we have a variety of overhangs that some of them lifted last week. I thought I'd start with that. Let's talk about the three major overhangs that was really out there for a while. We could probably list four. We had China, and China was concerned about their GDP. We saw the BP situation. We saw Goldman Sachs and FinReg. So three out of the four were actually partially lifted. Goldman Sachs paying $550 billion to settle claims of their supposed fraudulent transaction with CDOs and some relationship with Paulson. And then we also had the stock rally. Then we had the FinReg approved by Senate going to Obama's desk for signature. And we had the successful capping of the, well, at least it seems that way. We have to wait a few weeks, I guess, to see how it all plays out. And then we just saw China actually starting to slow down. Their CPI starting to actually come in a little bit, but their growth coming in. Pick one of them and let's run with it.
All right. Let's start with, let's start with China, I guess. I think everything that China is doing is absolutely great. I think China is a great growth market. They're doing exactly what they said they were going to do. And, you know, we're seeing a slowdown, which is good. I mean, they're a little nervous about inflation. They said they're going to do things to really slow down, especially the commercial real estate. I think everyone in the world knows there's a bubble in that market right now, which makes me think it's not going to explode as big as everybody believes. But I think with China, look, there's still an economy growing at 80% plus. I think that there's great opportunities. That market's gotten crushed. I think right now is definitely a chance to start looking at some equity investments there that trade on our markets that take advantage of the growth in China.
So let's just kind of go over this. You know, there was this real concern a number of months ago that China's markets could be in a bubble, and a lot of people were really nervous about the real estate markets. That was the big issue. So, but now, when China finally came out and did something to curb the amount of real estate appreciation, we'll call it, the amount of loans being put out, it seemed that they were doing a good job at that. But then everybody started getting nervous that the economy was slowing down, right? So we're not happy if it goes up. We're not happy if it goes down. We're miserable no matter what here, it seems.
It seems like it. And be careful when people talk about China, where there's a bubble in commercial real estate and regular real estate. You know, when we hear the word bubble, we think of what's going on here, where we had an enormous collapse of our financial system. They were giving loans away for free. It's not like that in China. I mean, they have to put down 30, 40% by law on these homes. And for the second home, they have to put down sometimes 50, 60%. Mm-hmm. So there's equity in these homes. So when these values come down, they're not going to walk away because they still have money. They have equity in our homes. And the problem we're seeing today is a lot of people saying, hey, you know what? I'm not paying for this mortgage, which is $500,000. My home is worth $300,000, $350,000. I have no equity in my home. Why am I paying this for? I'm leaving. I don't care. And they call those, you know, strategic default or whatever, where they could have paid them, but it doesn't make too much sense financially. You're not going to see that in China. So, you know, on the commercial side, yes. I mean, they just keep building and building, and it's getting really crazy there. But I think on the residential end, I don't think it's going to be that much of a bubble. And it is a bubble, but it's not going to be that much of a bubble because they're not going to leave their houses. You're not going to see these massive foreclosures. It's not going to be like that over here.
Well, but the thing is that when we look at the China market and you look at – well, first of all, let me state this. The word bubble is terribly overused.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's to a point that everything's a bubble. You can't have everything in a bubble. Bubbles have to be very specific, and they have to be very, very – almost, you know, bubbles don't happen all the time. Now, it may be overvalued, which is a much better word, or maybe even super overvalued. But the word bubble, you know, kind of has that connotation that there's going to be an imminent, not only a reduction, but a pop and an absolute, just a splattering of the pricing. So I think that we need to be careful with that, too. But so China...
Also, even to throw it in, I mean, the bubble, too, you have to realize before it bursts, it gets much, much larger. I mean, in 1997, technology was said to be in a bubble, and look through 1997, 2000. So not to say you want to play a market within a bubble, but maybe if you use, like, stop losses, you could take advantage of the market continuing to go higher. And if it does pull back, they nail your stop losses. But I'm glad you brought up the bubble comment.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that I agree with you that it's in any circumstance that markets can actually – move up or down, depending on how you want to look at it, much longer than anyone usually thinks they will. Oftentimes, the top end, the exuberance to be buying into something, whether it's real estate, whether it's a gold, whether it's the stock market, a stock, it often lasts much longer than you would think in terms of valuation. But just like with the economics, eventually, earnings and outlook and economics eventually catch up. But the one thing about China, we'll finish on this point, though, what do you think about the CPI number? That was interesting that it was actually down. I think that gave the government a potential for the ability to actually supply some more possible stimulus. And the difference, by the way, when we hear stimulus here, we're like, oh, my God, not that. I mean, they have a huge surplus there, just a tremendous surplus to provide a stimulus package or to pretty much just flush into the economy. And now they can do so, at least from the report. We don't know, again, a lot of question about the validity of the reports out of China, but at least the report is showing that there is a reduction in the consumer price index and inflation. What do you think about that?
I think, you know, I had someone on my podcast. His name is Braden Copeland. He's a research analyst at Stansberry & Associates, and he brought up a great point. When China wants to do something, when they want to change policy, they have like 10 guys in a room and they change it. Over here, I mean, people understand nothing ever gets done, and that's really been hampering the market. Maybe we'll get to that in a little while. But you see the policies, even the stimulus package, when they put it in place, that was it. It was in place. We still have, last time I looked, it's in between a half and three quarters that we didn't even spend yet. And a lot of companies don't want to hire because they don't even know if they're going to get that money. And that money's mandated to be spent by 2011. So I don't know what's going on with that. I don't know if a lot of these corporations are going to see it in infrastructure or whatever. But when things happen in China, they just happen so much quicker, and you could see it. And you know, I'm surprised it came out. Maybe it's just one month of data for CPI, but maybe that's it. But still, when they get things done, they really they get them done.
Yeah, no, it's a different. It's the difference between going through a filtering process versus a direct injection. You know, that's from here to there. All right, I have lots more on the list. So let's talk about, very quickly, let's talk about the Goldman situation. You think that the $550 billion that they paid and to part of it back to, I guess, investors, part of it directly to the Federal Treasury.
Or billion?
What did I say? Million. Did I say billion?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of money, billion.
Really? That would have been amazing. Wow, that would be something. $550 million with an M, which is still a lot of money, but the thought was that it was going to be a billion. Do you think it was a good amount?
You know what it is? With every stock pick, there's always an overhang. There's something that everyone's paying attention to. Sometimes it's margin, sometimes it's earnings, sometimes, whatever. It's subscription growth. What Goldman Sachs has been really dragging the stock down was this SEC thing. So the fact that they settled it, even though, the amount is large, not really large for what they're making, but it's good not to have that overhang where they're saying, okay, here's just money. Just get off our back. We're fine. And now everything's okay. Now, here's the thing. Do I think it's a buying opportunity? I would wait till after the quarter, and here's why. Bank of America came out, you know, we're seeing these earnings come out last week. Bank of America came out and they basically said, you know, everything was okay, even though the stock got hit. But one thing I did notice is their trading revenue was down tremendously, down 55 to 60%. Right, now, Meredith Whitney just lowered Goldman Sachs. She lowered Morgan Stanley by 60% and 40%. I think she lowered those earnings going into the quarter. I would wait till after the quarter because Goldman Sachs is, what is it, 60 or 70% of that money comes from their trading operations. If they have a bad quarter, you're going to see really terrible results. That stock will come down. I think that's the time to buy. But this is, you know, the SEC thing is great that they got it taken care of. You don't have that overhang. But I just wait till after they reported. And, you know, I think that would be a buying opportunity. I actually like all financials here.
You know, Citi, for example, also came out with earnings the same day that Bank of America came down. Bank of America was down like 7% after the earnings announcement. The earnings weren't terrible, but as a matter of fact, some of the things they talked about, they don't see a double dip in housing. On the conference call, they talked about how there was still some things going on, obviously, with their books that they're cleaning up, et cetera. But, I mean, but Citi doesn't have as much trading going on, right, as the big boys, they'll call them, JP and Goldman, Merrill, part of, you know, a Bank of America. So Citi comes out, and they actually beat by a few cents, and they come right on revenues. They come down with a number that was about $2 billion in reduction in bad debt, et cetera. And, you know, generally speaking, the numbers didn't look bad. It didn't look bad from the outside. GE comes in with numbers. They missed on revenues. They came in a little bit above. We know that the guy you work with, Stansberry, Porter Stansberry, mm-hmm. is an absolute, has a negative sentiment on GE. He thinks the bank, the company is going to, well, nothing.
Zero. He thinks it's actually going to zero. Right. And he has, you know, if you look at the numbers, it makes a lot of sense. Plus, if you look at GE, if you notice, they've been selling off their assets like crazy. And people say, well, gee, how could it go lower? They're paying a lower interest rate than everybody else. And even at that lower interest rate, it just seems like they're not going to be able to pay it over a consistent time. With the operating income that they have. Right. So it's going to be interesting. That's why you're seeing them sell everything right now. If you notice, it's always like every month it seems like GE is selling something else. It's America's stock. You're going to see it up. It's going to be interesting to see how it takes place. I don't know if I agree with them that it's going to zero, but I would not be a buyer. I'm just too skeptical of GE here.
Right. Now, what about – so you said you're like the other ones. I mean, did Citi come in that bad, or is it just kind of getting hit because everybody else seems to be getting hit? JP's numbers were actually good. They were actually upgraded last week as well by a couple of big players, and the stock just languished. Is it that they ran up too much in front of all this?
No, they actually didn't run up in front of this at all. I mean, well, we did have a little bit of a rally, but they've come down tremendously. With the two-month rally, they've got hit just as hard as everybody else, coming down 15, 20, some 25%.
Right.
But, you know, Citi wasn't that bad. And look, you know, sometimes you look at these reports and say, well, Citi wasn't that bad. How come it's down? JP Morgan was great yesterday, and that barely went up due to a late rally.
Right.
Stocks are going to go where they're going to go on a daily basis. There's nothing you can do to control that. I think if you're looking at the financials, and I've been on this program a lot, even on my podcast, I haven't been a fan of the financials. Right now, I'm a big fan of them because most of them are trading under book value. Every single analyst, including Meredith Whitney, lowered their estimates tremendously. You know, they're pricing in this reform bill, which, by the way, is a necessity. Forget about the politics. I mean, what happened in 2008, 2009, we almost had a collapse of the financial system. These guys, you know, leveraged through the roof and making tens of billions of dollars in bonuses because they want to be even more leveraged to try to make money. There needs to be some kind of changes. And you know what happens. It's going to probably be overdone. It's going to get a little crazy, but something needed to get done. But I think that, you know, financials right here with this pullback and a lot of them trading under book value, I think, you know, you could dip your toe in it. There's a lot of tailwinds. You have low interest rates. The IPO market's getting better. I just see this, you know, M&A activity, more cash on the balance sheets of these companies than ever. And you're seeing valuations come down tremendously. So you're going to see M&A activity pick up. I just think there's a lot of tailwinds there, and it's not going to be as bad as everybody says. And with sentiment this low on this industry, I think you can start picking away your favorite names.
You know, you saw the piece that we wrote, the quarterly commentary. We put out a quarterly commentary from our firm to our clients. We actually, if anybody's interested in that, we have a separate subscription available for that as well if you're not a client of Horowitz & Company. You saw that last week, right? Frank?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So we talked about in there, actually on page 11 here, the standard for residential loans and the demand for residential loans. And what was really interesting about that, and there's actually a couple of other things, was that the standards for residential loans starting about January of 2009 have come down dramatically, meaning that when the worst was happening in the markets in terms of the real estate market, and when you saw that the collapse was happening and people were starting to default, the banks were starting to, the step back. They're like, you know what? We're not lending any money. You know, they went from kind of a checkoff system saying, okay, approve him if he's breathing, to wait a minute, let's check everything. So the standards went way up. Now they're coming down. We're all seeing demand for residential loans starting to level off. It was a bit higher for a while, level off. But one of the things that has been, kind of bothering me was that when you look at the loan, now we're on the next page here, we put a nice chart on the loan spread above banks' costs. When you look about the loan spread above bank costs, what's happened is we all recognize that interest rates are not getting any lower when it comes to what banks can borrow money from the Fed at, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, they're at 0 to 1/4. It's not getting any lower. So on top of that, they are also seeing that interest rates are coming down. So, okay, so they don't have to pay out as much, of course, on their CDs and banking and savings accounts. But on the other hand, the amount that they're also taking in from mortgages and from any credit cards, et cetera, is actually compressing as well. So now the spread above the loan spread above the bank's cost, when you consider all the costs involved in the banks, et cetera, was at its peak in April, May of 2009 and has been coming down back to where normal spreads are. So I think the amazing run they had when it came to the fact that, of course they were at, some ridiculous numbers, a dollar and they went to $4, so it's a 400% run, but yet at the same time they were at 35 at one point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, do you think that banks still have the tailwind of some of the benefit of the Fed right now, or is that starting to compress on top of them?
No, they still have the benefit. I just bought a house in April from Wells Fargo, and 2 months later they said they sold the loan to Fannie Mae.
Right.
So it's almost like they're making the money in the business and they're throwing it out the back door to the government. But I still think that they have the tailwinds there. I think the government will always be there. Forget about what the reform bill says. If a Citigroup collapsed today, it would be an absolute disaster throughout the entire system, just like Lehman was. We're definitely years, if not decades, away from changing that system where they're just too tied together. They all own the same stuff and assets could collapse. And we saw that in 2008, 2009, when these leveraged companies, how many of you out there own companies and they traded at cash value? They were down 30%. The next thing you know, they'd be down 15, 20, 25% in the next week or so. You're like, what is going on? I don't understand. There's nothing wrong with the stock. There's no news on it. It's just forced selling. And if you think about that on a bank level, on a much bigger scale, when you talk about billions and sometimes trillions right. in a derivative market, right. If you get one of these banks that they have to and they're forced selling, they're still so linked together that so many people don't know about. But as far as the government help, I think the government is always going to be there, unfortunately.
Well, it's just the way it is. It's unfortunate that we have to have such a system that breeds such greed and such corruption. But it's from city councils all the way up to government, all the way out to private, corporate America and all over. So it's just the way it is. It's what we have to build into the assumptions when we're trying to calculate what's happening. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, and a lot of people are taking score now, which is good. They weren't taking score back in the day. Nobody cared about lobbying costs and how much is going to these politicians to change tax laws. Now everybody's really keeping score. Everyone's in tune with all this. And it's going to be interesting going down the line, what happens, especially with this reform bill. But it is going to be interesting. I think it's good. But I think as far as reducing the government or saying that any bank's too big to fail, I think the top five, they're bigger now than they've ever been. So
yeah, I agree.
It's going to be difficult.
They're like giant Pac-Man just eating up everything around them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, let me kind of rattle off a couple things to you, okay? I want to rattle off some economics that have happened over the last week or so in the U.S. and talk about the economics. And then I want to get into a couple of stocks that you really know very well and talk about some ideas that we have and some things that may be good or bad. But let me just kind of read a few things off. We saw consumer price index was actually down here again in the U.S. We saw on Friday, we saw the University of Michigan was actually disappointing, the lowest level it was since about August of 2009, which I guess you would expect after everybody saw their statements that last quarter when it came in and some of the things that are going on around the world. We saw that in addition to that, we saw that pretty much every manufacturing number was light. We saw the Philly Fed come in light, Empire Manufacturing come in light. I think, PPI come in about stagnant. We saw that overall there was really no good, I don't think there was any good economics in the last week or so, except for possibly the initial claims numbers that we could look at, but then there may have been some irregularities and some seasonal corrections that were involved there. So we're seeing some numbers that are coming in that are definitely either softer or at least, you know, at least at this point that are looking weaker. A couple things I'll mention, and then I want to ask you this one question. First, I think that in any growth, in any recovery, or any contraction, however you want to look at it, things don't go in one direction. You don't have them always going up. You don't have them always going up, down. That may be a trend that happens, but once the trend breaks and starts, doesn't mean it's turning around entirely the other direction. It can do that, by the way, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. Sometimes there is a softer number that comes out. You know, maybe it's the summertime, maybe it's pricing issues, maybe there's a shock to the system. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that. So in your opinion, Frank Curzio, what is this? Is this a soft patch? Is this a which is I'm just using the words that were out in the media right now. Not that I think the soft patch is a good number a thing to look at. Is it simply a pause, or is it something much more severe that's coming?
I don't know. It's difficult to say. I think we had a lot of optimism going on with the economy where we saw. I think the consensus estimates from some of these economists were a little out of hand. I mean, it started out with 4% GDP growth in 2011, and I didn't see that happening at all. We're definitely not going to see that. More like 2.5%, 3% now, and they're lowering 2010 to what is it, 3.2%.
Yep.
Is it a rough patch? Maybe it's a little bit of a rough patch, but there's a couple of ways to look at this. First of all, the data is definitely worse than expected, okay? And that's going to cause the market to go lower. But it's not indicating that we're going to have another Great Depression. And I'm seeing forecasts out there. I mean, some nuts calling for the Dow to go to 1,000.
Yeah, Robert Proctor.
You know, although cash balances are at the highest levels for S&P 500 companies, you know, you're looking earnings looking forward 12 times. Guys, that's not expensive. Yet, on the other end, we have enormous deficits, especially at the state level, unfortunately. I think you're going to see more layoffs, you know, teachers, firemen, sanitation, cops. I mean, it's just a matter of math. There's no money coming in and nobody wants to cut anything. So, you know, and I have a lot of friends in those professions. But it's just when you're looking at it, it just seems like everything's balanced out. It makes me think not that it's going to be like you have to be a day trader, but you have to be more like a 3-month trader or a 6-month trader, because it feels like we're going to have a trading range. And whenever we go low, you're going to see the bears jump on board and say, you know, look at these enormous deficits. And then whenever we go high, you're going to see people say, well, you know, earnings are great and they're cheap in the balance sheets. And you're going to see this fight between the bulls and the bears. And I think we're going to be range bound. And I know that that's not exciting for a podcast. You want to hear me say, well, the Dow's going to go to 15,000.
right.
But you know, I'm going to be honest with you because that's what we both do. And yeah, I think we're going to be range bound. And you're looking at the last 15, 17 days. We saw 9 straight days of a decline and the market collapsed. I mean, we would go down 12 to 15%. And then we saw a 7% rise in the Dow. I mean, these are major indexes that we used to get. I mean, listen, 10 years ago, 3% move in some of these was huge. We're seeing these within weeks now of 7% moves, 15% moves. And we're going to see that going forward because there's so many. There's a lot of positives, but a lot of negatives out there, if that makes sense. And you're just going to see that pull between the bulls and the bears for a while, I think.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in the old days, as you say, you know, when we started out in our careers, Frank, it was a 1% day was a big day.
Mm-hmm.
That was humongous.
It was, you know, huge.
3% was a year.
Yeah.
You know, 5% was a year. So I do agree with you. I think the volatility is a problem, though, because when you look back, I think we both discovered this in one of our discussions the other day. When you look back to what happened at the end of June, which was only a few weeks back, there was a question, what was going on? Why was there so much selling going on? What was happening? Barton Biggs sold out all of his technology or a chunk of his technology. We're talking about a huge basket of assets being sold off in a matter of 1 week. That takes down markets, especially markets that don't have a lot of volume during the summertime and because it's just a low-volume environment right now. So when you have that kind of situation happen, you have this forced selling going on from him. Mm-hmm. Paulson lost $3 billion of assets that were pulled from him after we had a terrible quarter. That had to be sold into the quarter so he could sell off and raise money. And who knows if they're getting loans from the banks that they would have gotten before. So all these things going in, we have that huge sell-off. So maybe this is just at this point, you know, getting back to where we should have been at that level and, you know, versus the, you know, close to the 1,000 level. But I got to tell you something, earnings look a little bit better right now and earnings are coming in on. I can't imagine that if earnings continue to be reasonable, Intel came out with a great – did Intel not come out with a great number?
You know what? Intel did come out with a great quarter, but I'm going to tell you something. It's a second quarter in a row that they came out with a brilliant quarter. But
right.
Going forward, remember, the inventory adjustments that we see that we've talked about many times, I really believe it hit this industry, the semiconductor industry, the best. Because when I was covering Stock Center 10 – these companies just, they didn't all, basically, with the exception of Intel and maybe a little bit of AMD, they were all, it seemed like they were all the same exact company. And whoever was the cheapest, that's who's going to do the most business. Right. And that's not a good business to be in. But when this inventory restocking cycle took place, these companies all took off and they've been on a pretty steady uptrend. And you're seeing this. So are things absolutely great for Intel right now? Yes. Were they great for them next quarter? Yes. But I find it very difficult to believe that Intel is going to have higher – were they going to have 70% margins? I find that very difficult for them to hit that type of margin growth going forward over maybe one more quarter. But I think that's why you're seeing that stock report, two great quarters, and it really didn't even budge because people are like, okay, what's going to happen next? Yeah, I mean, common sense tells you when someone says this is our best quarter in our 41-year history, 42-year history – the next quarter is not going to be the best quarter in a 42-year
Well, the history. Margins also, the gross margin of 67% was pretty remarkable. But the one thing that was interesting, I think, was that when he came out, when the management came out and talked in the conference call, not only was it a good quarter, but they have good things to say about the future. That's why the stock popped after hours. Now, if we exclude the whole after hours look, just forget that, throw it out the window, and just look at where the stock is generally speaking, it's nowhere, anywhere, you know, it's just where it was right before the earnings came out. Maybe a little bit lower. That was the thing that was surprising to me.
Yeah, and I think it's just people are, I think, are nervous about the future if they're going to see that kind of growth a year from now. But it's amazing because you see a company put up the quarter that people who bought it ahead of time expected, saying, I know this quarter is going to be great. It's going to be awesome. It was, and not to get that price movement is frustrating. But again, when we're looking at earnings season, it's not about the past 3 months. People want to learn about the future. That's what moves stocks. You could report a horrible quarter but raise guidance, and chances are your stock's going to go up because people only care about the future. That's what investors look at. The future for Intel, I don't know if it's going to get any better than it is today. I think maybe that's why it's just staying at this level.
Yeah, it hasn't moved in a while, though. That and Alcoa have had the same pattern that they come out with earnings. Alcoa's numbers were okay, and they increased the outlook, and the stock still went nowhere.
Yeah, that's true too. And I was surprised because it was up a lot, on the earnings, but and it did pull back again. Yeah,
right. Let me just throw this in there, just for just to spice up the show for a second. Frank being a Knicks fan, we got LeBron.
Actually, I'm actually a Detroit Piston fan. I was never a Knicks fan, but I felt so terrible because I want all my Knicks fans. I really believe the New York Knicks have the worst franchise in sports history, considering the size of the market they have. I've never seen a team that bad in that size of a market ever. But how they did not get LeBron, well, maybe it was because of taxes. I don't know if you read that in the Wall Street Journal. He's going to save $16 million by playing in Florida.
But I also heard a great discussion about how Pat Riley did such an amazing job with the salary cap numbers, and this was planned about 4 years in advance.
You know, he might have. I think, look, to be honest, I'm a basketball player. I love basketball. I've been playing for 15 years. There's no better feeling than playing with your friends. And he's got a chance to play with his friends. And so I think it was an easy decision. I think the whole decision show was terrible. In 20 years, he's going to look back and say, I can't believe I was that stupid to do something like that. You should have called the president for Cleveland. You should have called the president for you should have called Pat Riley for Miami and said, listen, you know, those are two guys involved, and just, you know, do what you had to do. But this whole, you know, you're seeing a guy who's making a great move for his career. It's supposed to be fun, and he was just totally stressed out. I just didn't think it made sense. It was horrible.
I can't believe
I wasted my time.
I know. I hear you. Okay, let's moving along, though. Let's talk about some other things that are more central to the idea of making some money. You put out a report, I don't know when it was, maybe I think it was 2 months ago, regarding the fertilizer companies.
Mm-hmm.
And you were pretty bullish on, I think, Potash, the company Potash, POT. Since then, we've seen the price of Potash move up, move down, move up, move down, you know, somewhere in the range of 88 to 120, down and all over the place. Very much a mover these days. Do you still have, first of all, do you still have good long-term vision that you believe this is going to, you know, the sector and the stock itself will be a good play?
I think this sector and a stock is a good play. And let me remind you guys, I was dead wrong on my call. I think it was like 110, 112, and it came down, so I was a little early. But, you know, I do like the fertilizer companies. I think even a better area for fertilizer companies are in China. I like that market much better. I mean, just not even that. It's the organic fertilizer companies. People don't realize, like, China's actually running out of land to produce food. And, you know, they've been pouring so much fertilizer on their land that they have to go to, like, organic because it's really killing the land. So
are they also using urea like India is, or are they using higher level fertilizers?
You know what? The two companies that I follow, and one of them is Yongyi International, I really like. Uh-huh. They have a patented formula that's sold in like individual stores to individual farmers. But, you know, it's just people see the enormous amount of growth, and they don't realize that that growth is taking place on the same exact amount of the arable land. So as it becomes more industrialized, there's less arable land. So they have to do – they have to produce more crops somehow, and that's
so. That's something I didn't know. That you're telling me that the immense space in China, they don't have. Oh, because they have mountainous regions, I guess too.
Exactly.
Which is not, yeah, it's not so much the space itself; it's just that the space that they can actually, farm on.
Yeah, it's like 14% of the industrialization. That place, it's taken away from the arable land that can produce goods. So. And they're actually coming to critical levels where, you know, I'm not going to go out there and say that, they can't feed their people. They'll always find that. But there's actually a level where the government has them like on red alert saying, okay, it's coming down to that level where we have to do something. So I think I really like the fertilizer companies there as well. I think they're a great place.
You know, we saw that over the last few weeks that there had been a few days that in the, and I don't know if everybody knows this, but in the pits, when you're trading corn and cotton and a variety of it, lumber, et cetera, there actually are limit ups and downs for the day where trading will be halted for the day. For example, you get a limit up open on a corn. It's 10%. So and for those of you that are commodity traders, you know a lot more about this. We don't really trade commodities. But the bottom line is there's been a lot of days recently that we've seen tremendous movement in the ags. One of the ways you can play that is through a ETF with the symbol DBA. It's been horrible over the last year, but all of a sudden we're seeing a pickup in that, and that is correlating a bit with the fertilizer stocks like Mosaic and Potash, CFAGU. There's a few of them out there, but the bottom line is that, you know, we own Potash. We bought it down a bit lower from here, and one of the reports that you and I actually you put out the report, but I gave you some data about that and some of the amount of usage of it. India also seems to be requiring a lot greater use of the potash, even though prices are coming down a bit, but the requirements they have, because they've pretty much decimated their land, is dramatic. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out. What about when we talk about switching over to technology for a second? You know, technology, I told you Barton Biggs sold out, when was it, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, all of his technology, and he missed that gigantic run-up. He sold out actually the day when he sold out. Google's numbers came out, and there was a very harsh reaction to their numbers. They missed by about, I think, 7 cents. But the big issue and the report that came in, from what I can see, is that there was some concern about the money they were spending on competition measures to keep up with the likes of like Apple and Facebook. Now, also, you have to extract out any of the losses they have due to their China play and the loss in China, even though they got their license reinstated. What do you think about Google here? Is it kind of like a dead fish or what?
You know what? I kind of think it is. And Google is a great, great, great company. It's just not that good of a stock because it's been such a great company for such a long time. And it's grown to enormous levels. I don't think I've ever seen a one-product company grow without really a threat of competition for such a long time. And, you know, to see them being one of the biggest companies in the world, and they're the greatest, and I use Google. I'm not kidding. I use Google 25 times a day probably, at least 25 times a day.
Right.
But you have to look at eventually.
Yeah, but what do you do with it? Do you click on anything?
Well, no, I don't.
So that means Google gets nothing.
For search.
Right, but
search.
Google gets nothing from you then.
But you know, I use the product. But you're looking at when you look at the numbers, you're talking about a company that's trading at anywhere from, you know, 12 to 14 times earnings when I looked at it a couple weeks ago. I don't know. It's definitely going to be different after the report just came out. And they're only growing the top line by 7%. So you're looking at that. It's not a bargain. You're better off buying Apple at 15, 17 times earnings, and they're growing, you know, by 25%. So, you know, I think Apple's a better play. And unfortunately, they get compared to Apple so much. And Apple is just – and I've never seen anything like it, to the point where a company that big and enormous to be able to grow at 20, 25%, it makes me think down the line, you know, I would be a little nervous on Apple going forward where, you know, I mean, for companies that have to come up with a brilliant, unbelievable product like the iPad time after time after time after time, it, you know, that you're setting the bar very, very high for yourself. And, you know, we've seen this throughout history where it comes to Microsoft, Yahoo, wherever it is. Eventually, these companies are so great and grow so enormous that, you know, eventually it's going to slow. You see, you know, more numbers as you get bigger, it's gonna you're going to see slower growth.
Yeah, but right now, Frank, I got to tell you something about Apple. I agree with you, by the way. Innovation
not has been, now in Apple.
Not
I'm
now.
Not saying
right. You got a few years because right now what they need to figure out is how to keep up with the demand. That's what they have to figure out right now. It's ridiculous, and that's why they didn't allow for original launches of some products in Europe or China or Asia, wherever it was at the time they came out. I just read a variety of different reports from different players around the industry to try to really put together what we're dealing with Apple here right now, because they range from the absurd amount of sales. I mean, numbers that will just make your head spin on the iPhone 4 and the iPad, for example, as well as Mac sales and iPods, etc. iPods are probably going to be taking a little bit of a backseat between the iPad and the iPod and the iPhone, because it obviously has it built in and the iTouch, etc. But the numbers, if you start getting into, they just opened up another store in China, but you start getting into the China region, you start getting into some of the mass countries that are getting them right now illegally on the black market, and you start really expanding into that, I mean, we're talking a whole different dynamic here. You saw Research and Motion's numbers a few weeks back. They were horrible. Now, Google is catching up, but here's the interesting thing. Google, you know, with the Droid X that just came out this week, and the Droid and the variety of phones that are out there, the Nexus One. But the problem is that with Google, they're not making money on the standalone Android. It's an open source. I went through this with John Dvorak on DH Unplugged, and he confirmed it because on Cranky Geeks, which is a show he does, he had a Google manager on there and talked about a couple different things. Number one, the China situation, but also there's no money to be made for Google on an open source that they do not put on their phone. So all these great sales that are going on by Motorola and whoever else and maybe Sprint, they are not coming to the bottom line of Google like everybody thought they would. Because there's just no money in Android unless they sell the Nexus One, which is their own product.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about Apple too. We're looking at, you know, I was reading some statistics where it's about 82% of people, or 80-82%, have a cell phone or have some kind of subscription plan in the U.S. But when you're looking at smartphones, that number goes down dramatically. I mean, like 20-25% still. And you're going to see everybody have a smartphone because, one, it's easy to use. Two, it's affordable. It really is affordable right now. I think the older model for the iPhone is, what, $99, I believe?
Yeah, well, nobody wants that anymore, but yeah, it's pretty
cheap. But I'm talking about the lower-end people who are just like, you know, your mother, your grandmother, whatever. Instead of getting like the cheapest phone, that, you know, pretty soon they're going to be giving away smartphones as long as you buy the plan. So that market's going to be even bigger. So I think that you know, Apple still has plenty more growth here, and like you said, in other countries. I just think, you know, eventually the sheer size of this company is just enormous that, you know, if you're looking 2-3 years down the line and you have to come up with that super-duper product, can they do it? I'm not to doubt them. I'm not going to doubt them because they do it every time, but it's just something to think about.
It's something we don't know what's going to be yet. There seems to be an endless bid in this market. You know, we've been seeing these ups and downs and all that, but there seems to be a general hand. You know, you just look, what day was it last week? I think it was Thursday. That the markets were down, they were down like 1.5% or so, and then by the end of the day, they all popped up to basically even with about 30 minutes after the BP capped the well, after the Goldman Sachs situation. There seems to be a lot of money that seems to be flowing in and out on a daily basis, and right now the bid is there after it wasn't there for some time. Do you think sentiment's changed at all, or is it still just, you know, whatever the day brings is what the day is going to bring? Because, and let me just throw this other question in here. It seems that for the most part, unless it's a special situation with a stock from earnings or maybe an upgrade, it seems like stocks all move together now.
Yeah, I would kind of agree. Yeah, I mean, some of the sectors get hit a little bit more than others, but yeah, I would definitely agree with that. You know what this market lacks, though? There's just so much institutional buying and selling going on, and people just, you know, the traders coming in and out of this market where, I mean, you remember probably about 3-4 years ago, yeah, all your friends own stocks, even though, you know, they had other jobs not really related to it. They'd buy Disney, they'd buy whatever. But, you know, the amount of money from the individual investor that's coming out of this market because they see, you know, the BP, you know, the oil spill getting capped, and they're like, well, you know, that's good news. And then they see, you know, the market getting crushed. or you know whatever they say. It's just you know, they'll look at Intel earnings and blow out the numbers, and then Intel's you know doesn't even move and comes down. It's just it's so difficult for the individual investor these days because it seems like they're not on a fair playing field with everybody else, like the Goldman Sachs and everybody else who's just. I mean, these markets are being moved tremendously right now, but it doesn't seem like there's that much action from individual investors.
I would tend to agree with that. I definitely would. So the other thing is gold. Gold has been moving up dramatically, and then you know it was moving up on the currency issue, the concern about the euro, which by the way hit very close to 130 before it started just taking a little bit off the top. I was pretty surprised with that. 126, 127 was kind of the number we were looking at. What do you think about that? Is that 130? Is that sustainable? What's that? What's happening? Is it the U.S. dollar just getting weaker? Or?
Yeah, I think that's what it has to do with it. And remember, the euro's come down so far, so fast, and it was so many people on that trade. Remember, they were talking it's going to come to parity. And you know, when that happens and you hear that talk, it's kind of like almost a time that to reverse your position there. So I think everybody's just – when everybody's on one side, it's almost like natural gas. Even though fundamentals don't make sense at 370, 380 – you know, it's just, you know, eventually people are going to say, you know what, okay, I made my profits and get in. You might see a pop, which we saw in natural gas. But I think the same is happening to euro, and we're seeing that move up.
So will that, do you think, what's going to happen with gold? I mean, right now there's been a lot of talk that, you know, there's going to be a common currency and gold is the only play. But at the same time, gold seems to be deflating with the fact that even though there's still some turmoil out there, that there's no inflation. I mean, let's get to that. Is there inflation anywhere that you're seeing that it's significant?
There is inflation. Yeah, I think there's inflation. Anyone who pays their bills has inflation. I mean, DirecTV raised my bill 3 times, I think, in the past 5 months. Seeing food prices more expensive on my end. I'm seeing electricity bills more expensive. I have to pay water expensive. I mean, when you throw real estate into the mix, it kind of like skews those figures a little bit. But yeah, I think everyone that's listened to this could probably agree with me that your cable bill keeps going higher and higher and higher, and they keep charging you more and more. But I do see inflation. The numbers on the whole, no, it's a deflationary environment. And you know what? Gold is not a deflationary play, and it's been keeping up well near 1,200. But if you're looking at the fundamentals of gold, production has been declining since 2001. And then you have the government. You know we're going to see an enormous amount of more spending because not only is it an inflation play, it's also a protection against a currency collapse. And we're not out of the woods yet. I wouldn't go as far as some people think that, you know, the dollar is doomed and that's it. I wouldn't go that far. But as long as we keep having the stimulus spending, which we're going to see in Europe, we're going to see over here, which is two of the biggest markets, you're going to see gold hold up well. And you know, if you look at some of the big guys, you're looking at all you know, the major growth countries buying gold. You're seeing the top hedge funds in the world, SEC Capital. You're seeing Paulson, all of them buying gold. You're seeing the major investment fund, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs. They're all buying gold. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of these guys go into gold. They're not doing it as a trade either. It's not something that they're doing as a trade, I don't see. So I think the fundamentals will hold up. It's definitely not in a bubble market. Could it pull back? Absolutely. It's been up so much. You could see a 10, 15% pullback. If that does happen, I'd use it as a buying opportunity. But I think everybody should have some kind of gold in their portfolio, just at the right price. I think you have to wait a little bit. That will probably come down.
Now, you just did a big piece on gold. So, I mean, actually, now that I think about it, you just did something for the Phase One investors over at – or subscribers over at Stansberry. And, of course, by the way, just if anybody doesn't know, Frank has a great podcast. It's called – why don't you tell them what it's called, where to find it.
It's called S&A Investor Podcast.
Right, S&A. It's easy. S&A. Like it would be – Frank and Andrew, if it was F&A, but it's S&A.
Exactly.
It's S&A. We've always toyed about doing a podcast together. But S&A Podcast, go get it over at iTunes. We'll put a link on it, of course, on the Discipline Investor show notes, and we'll put some of the things that we've talked about as well on there. But you put out a piece. It's a subscription piece for subscription only on a gold play. And I told you that I thought it was pretty – I mean, I read the headlines, and I was like, whoa, Frank. I mean, that was pretty impressive. I mean, you know, you're talking about this unbelievable investment, and it was strange timing because it was right in the heart. Was it 2 weeks ago or something like that? Or last week, it was right in the heart of the negative sentiment towards deep water drilling. And you come up with this story about how great this company is on deep water drilling for gold.
and it's deep water, not necessarily drilling, but deep water, that they're going to explore the deep water for gold. Right. And it really is an amazing play. And you know, people who know me, I'm not a dramatic guy. I would actually say that this is one of the greatest gold exploration companies I've ever seen, because they have a chance to change the landscape of an industry. With that said, there are enormous risks, because this has never been done. They're combining different technologies. And what they're doing is they're exploring the bottom of the ocean in areas like Papua New Guinea and areas like Fiji. And when the plates move and a volcanic, there's volcanoes down there, and they're very, very rich in minerals. Everybody knows it's there. It's just, how do you get it? This company actually is exploring how to get it. And what really made me recommend this company is they have unbelievable list of investors. They have Anglo-American Tech Resources Gaz Metal, who's been buying stakes in Facebook as a largest shareholder. You're looking at Barrick Gold, largest gold producer in the world. They all have stakes in this tiny $2 company. And I think it's the what if factor. And if you're looking back at 1930, when we started offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, a company called Texas Company, which is now Texaco, when they were doing it, it was, you know, I was like, what are these guys, crazy? And look at the Gulf of Mexico today. Now, the biggest thing is you're seeing, you know, BP and oil. You're not going to see oil come up. Actually, it's a lot more safer to exploring for gold than it is. You know, you're not going to see the pipes.
Right, you don't got to go down another 12,000 feet. You're dealing with only maybe hundreds of feet.
Exactly. You're going down 1 mile, not an additional 2,000-4,000 feet. The play makes a lot of sense in that. And they just received an environmental permit, which is enormous, because right after the environmental permit, they usually get the mining permit. So once they got that 6 months ago, that's when I really started doing a research on the company. And I said, look, if you're a millionaire and you have $10,000 and you want to put into a situation where, hey, you know what, I'm going to limit my losses, put a 25% stop loss. But if this company is able to change the landscape of an industry and you have these big investors involved, you could earn 5-10 times your money. It's that type of stock. That's not saying that it's for everybody, but if you're looking for that type of stock, then it makes sense.
Interesting play. I encourage you. I don't know if you have the sample of that on the Stansberry site, but this is quite a report that's pretty, I don't know, I thought it was pretty cool.
Thanks.
I know a lot of people really. I know you got a lot of people interested because the gold bugs kind of got a little freaky on it, huh? They're like,
yeah,
oh, whoa,
yeah,
what do you mean talking about gold? What do you got?
Yeah, and it's funny. You know what it is? It's just a concept where a lot of research analysts that I saw, they have these numbers, and they're actually exploring in a small part off of Papua New Guinea, an area that's the size of 13 rugby fields. And people say, well, if they pull gold and copper out of there, they're going to earn X amount of money and have discounted cash flow of like $2 a share in 2013. I said, basically, forget about those estimates, because if they're able to successfully take gold out of that deep water, put it on a boat and store it and make money off of it, the size of that field is 13 rugby fields. The size of all their operations just in Papua New Guinea is a size of 640,000 rugby fields.
But so is the there, potential but is they can enormous. Also are they going to also sell their technology and how to do this? You know, in other words, so you have all the finds that they have, but what if a company wants to say, hey, you know what, we think we have a great opportunity under our land? Will they actually lease or sell their mining?
It's not the company and the land; it's more like the countries, because they've changed laws where anything 200 miles off the coast is considered your property, and whatever happens in there. So it's basically, it's not really the companies; they're the only company that has licenses. Deep war, those licenses all the way out that far in Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Solomon Islands. So they have plenty of area to do it. I think once they do it, the biggest news would be for this company is if one of their biggest investors, like a Barrick Gold or a Tech Resources, said, hey, you know what, we're going to partner with you now and we want to do this. I think that this stock really could take off, because that means it really is for real. But I think it's going to happen. There's no doubt in my mind the timing could be longer than I expect. Again, it's a very speculative situation. But I really do, from a risk-reward standpoint, yeah, it's a great situation.
Cool. So, let's just kind of finish it up and talk a couple of things. It seems like the situation in Europe is abating a bit. And again, it's probably going to crop up its ugly head sometime. You know, we saw that euro drive up pretty well. I have a list here of the earnings that are coming up. Now, this week that just passed is the start of the official, you know, they say with Alcoa coming out and, JP and all this, Intel start. But next week is where things get really hairy.
Mm-hmm.
We have IBM coming out on Monday, Steel Dynamics, Texas Instruments on Monday before and after the close. We have Delta Airlines. And on Tuesday, we have Goldman. We have Harley-Davidson, Illinois Tool, Millicom, United Health, Whirlpool, PepsiCo, Peabody Energy. Then we have Apple after the close on Tuesday, America Mobile. Let's pull a few more. Seagate will tell us about the industry in terms of the disk drives. We have VMware, Yahoo, Abbott Labs. I mean, this list is, and I'm only talking about a few of them. I have, you know, pages and pages. Then we have Coca-Cola, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo. I mean, what is your, it seems to me, when, let me back up. Let me tell you about what you and I have been talking about. You and I have been talking about that. We saw that earnings will probably be really good and at least consistent with some growth and some decent revenue on the top top and bottom line. Both sides will be pretty good in through maybe through the end of this year. That's what we've always talked about. And then 2011, we have some concerns about. We have a lot of concerns about, you know, stimulus spending ends. You know, consumer, are they going to pick it up? What happens with all the outside influences around the world? You know, we're going to have a slowdown, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you and I were both surprised that it seemed that that was pulled up a little bit. Markets corrected very deeply, about 16-17% in the U.S. Obviously, we see around the world a lot of things happening. China down 25% this year. Europe a mess. And the emerging markets kind of coming up, coming down, coming up, coming down. And we were very surprised that we saw the market react as we did very suddenly. And of course, we understand why. But do you think that we're still going to see that in through 2011, decent earnings, and then 2011 starts to, you know, show a whole different face of the corporate environment in terms of earnings and revenue?
You know what? That's the million-dollar question right there, because I think that's what's really pushing these markets lower, and you're not able to forecast that far out with everything going on, where, you know, you have financial reform, banks don't want to – banks may need to have to raise money. You're talking about other corporations. Is a stimulus going to come in? Are we going to see more stimulus? And you know, people are – it seems like to me, from what I hear, that people are pretty close to starting to hire. On a lot of things that I'm reading, they're pretty close to starting to hire, but they really can't because they don't know what's going out 6 to 12 months from now. So the short term – and here's the reason why you're seeing a lot of companies come out and report great earnings, and now, you know, the stocks are coming down. Is basically, I don't know anybody that didn't think this earnings season was going to be terrible. Everybody said it was going to be good. So, you know, 6 to 12 months from now might be a little more difficult. It's very hard to say, and, you know, I'd like to give you guys an answer, but I would think earnings are not going to be as strong in 2011 because we keep kicking that can down the road. Eventually, we're going to have to deal with it when it turns to debts and deficits. And, you know, we will be able to deal with it. These balance sheets are enormous right now. They're filled with cash. But on the earnings side and demand side, we're going to need job growth. And I don't know if we're going to get that, past 6 months from now.
But from what we saw last week with JP, Bank of America, again, we had more banks that were slanting things, Alcoa. We can't say that in general, that earnings were bad. They hit. Everybody hit.
Oh, absolutely.
So the market reaction was more on the economic side in the outlook when you look at consumer confidence and you look at the manufacturing numbers. But there's this very mixed signals because we all saw that the inventory restocking cycle doesn't last forever. You don't see them just kicking up and continuing on forever. And, you know, that we have to get into the next, which is the sales cycle. And retail sales, of course, came in a little bit softer than expected. There's a lot of reasons for that. You know, we have also the issue of, is it going to be more stimulus? That right now, they have not yet been able to approve the continuation of the extended benefits for unemployment. And the general climate in Washington and politically, the political will is unable to actually move any of that. I am not suggesting that we do more spending, but I got to tell you something. It is not time for austerity yet in the U.S. It may seem like a good idea. Let me tell you something. Anybody who's looking for austerity right now has not lived in that environment. It's going to be nasty. Mm-hmm. We are not yet ready to take the training wheels off of the bicycle rider right now, being the U.S. economy. And until we do so, if we rip those off too fast, a lot of pain's going to happen. And whether or not that person will ever get back on their bike or not is a big issue. If we do, in fact, do a little bit more stimulus, which I hate the idea, by the way. I hate the idea from the fact that it costs more money down the road. It does kick the can down the road. But I think you need to keep kind of the choke on for a little while longer, right, before the car warms up entirely.
Absolutely. You have to keep it on longer. But you have to realize as we keep it on longer, it's going to hit us more in the future. So it's just a matter of time. We can't come out of a period where we were close to another Great Depression where the market almost collapsed, and in 1 year we're okay. It's just common sense says – you know, that just doesn't happen. You can't just change a couple things, lend a couple companies money, and in 12 to 18 months, everything's fine. So I agree with you. I think we're going to see more stimulus. I just think the hope factor down the end makes me really nervous, which may surprise you because I'm talking about, you know, short term, I still think that there's a lot of buying opportunities. Longer term, though, it's just how we're going to deal with these problems, how we're going to deal with these debt issues. It's just a matter of math. There's not enough money coming in. There's, you know, these bonuses. That, you know, I lived in New York, and even the friends that I talked to, they used to give out $5, $10 million bonuses. They're gone, and they cut, 30% of their employees. That money's not coming in. Where are they going to get the money to pay the employees under the state system? So, you know, the math's not there. It's just not there. I don't know how it's going to be there. Maybe it's just going to, appear suddenly, whatever. But down the line, it really does make me nervous, and not to put a damper at the end of this call.
No, I agree. I totally agree with you. It's just that, you have to this is the balancing act right now. The balancing act is there are some pockets around the world that are actually looking really good, first of all. There are some pockets around earnings that look really good. But the question is, of course, it's always the outlook. And the question then becomes, when is that outlook going to come to pass? And, as we keep on knocking down worse economic conditions and they kind of, continue to flow in, that's a negative. Yet at the same time, if earnings, when does earnings trump that? If earnings come in right on where they're supposed to be, that's a big question. And then on top of that, you're looking at analysts looking at 2011 at $92 on earnings on the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. You saw those numbers. I think they're ridiculous, by the way.
They are ridiculous. Right. They're going to have to come down.
I think they're ridiculous, but that's the number they have. But that's what they have. So we'll see. We'll kind of wrap it up with that, some good and bad news. And there is a lot of confusion in the market, and probably that's why there's so much volatility right now. That makes sense. I mean, if we all had a clear path towards something, whether it's good or bad, it'd be a much different direct move. But when you're seeing a stock market up 1.6 one day, down 2.2% the next day, down up 1.5%, and that's just uncomfortable. But the question is, where does it end up? Is it higher or lower in the end? And, how does it work? So Frank Curzio, the great, the wonderful, the very, very fun to talk to, Frank Curzio, Stansberry & Associates, SNA Radio. It's on the iTunes store and plenty of other places you can get it. He has some great guests that come on. I encourage you to check that out. Of course, he writes a couple different newsletters over at Stansberry. You can find out all about that over at Stansberry.com, and we'll put some links on that. Thanks so much for joining me. I know you're coming down here soon. You and I are gonna play a little ball, maybe some golf. You let you beat me in basketball.
Sounds great, man. Right. Just let me know when. I'm definitely down here. Hopefully next month.
All right. Talk to you soon. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
That was great with Frank. Hopefully you enjoyed it today. Hopefully you got some good information about that. We talked about, by the way, on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, about the China growth situation. There's some articles there about Apple. There's a variety of things on there that concerns the weekly economics, the things, for example, about the employment numbers that you need to look at, and each and every day, we put a couple of things up there that may be of interest. Hopefully you'll find of interest. And for those of you that are waiting to figure out when it's time to invest, and you're kind of scratching your head going, well, is it now? I don't know what to do. You know what? We have a way for you to take a look at it. Simply go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, check out the 14-minute video, and it will provide you all the information that you need with how we invest money, what we do for our clients, $50,000 minimum. But if you like the things that we've said here and on DH Unplugged, these are the kind of things that we implement, and it can be available for you and providing you a full, transparent experience. Each and every week, we also provide our clients a whole rundown of what's gone on the week that's private only for our clients, as well as economic commentaries. I mentioned that before. The quarterly Horowitz & Company economic commentary is available to you if you want. Send me an email to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There is a cost for it. It's actually $3.99 for a year, $99 per quarter. You can just do it regularly so you can get it each and every one, plus special reports from us on different economic discussions. But if you're interested in that, it's about a 20-page discussion. This time we talk about the relationship between the past depressions, recessions, economic slowdowns, as well as we talk about the kind of what it looks like comparing and contrasting those to today. Kind of interesting, I thought. And then goes over each and every economic outlook, as well as what does the yuan revaluation unpegging mean to us and around the world. So if you're interested in that, send me an email to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll make sure that you're subscribed with that. Other than that, we'll see you next week. Lots to come up. We're actually going to have a special show with myself in 2 weeks from this one with Kevin Hoffman from my office. We're going to talk about some of the basics, getting back to basics, and some ways to identify stocks, and have some lists of you for you on some stocks to take a look at and some ETFs as well. And until next time, I hope you have a profitable week. I'll see you soon. Thanks for listening. Thanks for coming on board the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.